The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone, where local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO abduction phenomenon. Our guest today is Mr. Chuck Zukowski. For about 35 years, Chuck has been investigating the UFO and paranormal phenomenon. As a field investigator, he's appeared on radio and television shows discussing his investigations. Chuck approaches every investigation from a skeptical point of view, looking for any known possibilities before claiming otherwise. He also implements innovative field experiments from time to time to enhance his investigations, looking for new evidence. In September of 2016, famed writer from Boston, Mr. Ben Zurich, released his book, The 37th Parallel, The Secret of Truth Behind America's UFO Highway. His book was written about Chuck Zukowski and his life involved with the UFO phenomenon. It was a New York Times bestseller for 2 months and has been optioned for a movie from Warner Brothers and New Line Cinema. In June of 2019, Chuck hosted his own TV show on the Travel Channel called Alien Highway with his son, Daniel Zukowski, and ghost investigator, Heather Taddy. He and his team traveled to 8 states in 8 one-hour episodes covering some of Chuck's personal investigations. Alien Highway was depicted many times by mainstream media as one of the top TV shows to watch on Wednesday nights. And we're happy to have him on with us today. And welcome to the show, Chuck.
Yeah, thank you very much. You know, interesting thing about, you know, the whole Ben Mezrich thing was, Ben Mezrich, a couple of his books, he basically writes his books for movies, and a couple of his books were in movies. One was about the MIT students that broke Las Vegas, and the other one was about Facebook. So, you know, and I was doing a investigation episode for Unexplained Files Season 2, talking about my 37th degree latitude theory. I mentioned it briefly in season one. I was on one of their episodes, and they contacted me when they got season two and said, "Hey, what's up with this theory? You know, would you be able to give us some information on it?" And I sent them just loads of information on it. They go, "Oh my gosh." They said, "Would you mind doing would you like to do a full 1 hour episode all yourself, and you get to design it the way you want to?" I'm going, "Wow, that's pretty cool." And this was for the Science Channel. Mm-hmm. So I did, you know, we did the 37th parallel or the Paranormal Highway of America episode. for the Science Channel season 2 of Unexplained Files. Well, this guy, Bo Flynn from Flynn Pictures Production from LA, saw the episode. He said, man, this would make a great movie. You know, this guy's theory about, you know, these bases, underground bases across the US of alien bases and some other cool things. So what he did is he contacted me and then told me that Ben Mezrich, this famous writer from Boston, was going to contact me and would write a book about, you know, about my life and about, you know, my theory and other things. And then once the book is published, they would write a screenplay. So it's like the cart before the horse type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I go, okay, you know. So the bottom line was, so I met Ben.
Pays on in, right?
Yeah. So I met Ben and you know, we talked for about 6 months on and off. He wrote the book before the book was actually published, he gave a copy to Bo Flynn, and Bo Flynn was pitching it for a movie, and New Line Cinema picked it up. And so I signed a life rights agreement with New Line Cinema over my theory, the 37th, degree latitude theory. And then the book came out in September of that year. And it was a, New York Times bestseller for like 2 months. And it was a lot of fun. You know, I got to go to the book release. And so anyway, it's sitting out there now. I mean, if people want to read the 37th parallel, they go to Amazon, you can pick up a paperback copy for $5, and you can pick up used copies, but it's pretty cool. Some of the interesting things in that book was some of the things that I knew about before they went public. And what was interesting about that was when I was with MUFON, Star Team Investigator, I knew that Robert Bigelow, who was funding the Star Team, was actually not funding it himself, that he was pretty much being funded by someone within our government. And I had enough evidence to prove it to me without making a big deal about it. And it really wasn't that much of a big deal as far as I was concerned, because there was a lot of interesting things going on with Bigelow.
Who was that someone in the government?
Well, at the time, I thought it was the CIA, but after the fact, you know, if anybody reads the book, the 37th parallel, Paranormal Highway Across America, they'll see at the very end of the book. Not that I'm, want to tell people how the end of the book is, but you can't end a book when the guy's still alive doing investigations. But so there's some interesting things in there that allude to someone in the government that's funding this and other things that I found out, but we don't directly answer those questions, because all I had was, I had enough information I knew, but I didn't have enough that I would want to publish it. Besides, Robert Bigelow's a billionaire and I'm a hundredaire. So, and I can't compete with that, So anyway,
It really doesn't matter how much money he has or how much money you have. Truth is truth. And that's what we try to discover on this show, and I'm sure on your show. Let's find out the truth. So what is the truth on that?
Well, that was the case. He was funding the Star Team. It turned out that he was funding it for the Pentagon in 2017, when information was released that the Pentagon had UFO, they were investigating UFOs, and
right.
And the primary person that was getting the majority of the millions of dollars turned out to be Robert Bigelow, or Bass, organization. And that's who was funding the Star Team. So it all kind of made sense afterwards. I later on used Bass, or Robert Bigelow, when my sister Debbie and I, we were doing an archaeology dig for the Sci-Fi Channel and for one of their programs. And we didn't particularly like how we were digging. And we didn't, we were basically just volunteer archaeologists for a TV show. But hell, they had us digging like in the Jurassic period, and all we needed to go back to was 47. So that's a whole other story. But basically, we were able to convince the lead archaeologist, Dr. Bill Dolman, with the University of New Mexico, to let us come back, you know, a day after the TV show wrapped up and run our own dig. And that was really nice of them to do that. And we did. And we did it a lot differently. Some things that I learned when I was doing Anasazi excavation, volunteer Anasazi excavation. So I was doing those type of techniques, which is called strip, you know, excavation. You don't dig down. You do 1 by 5 meter strip digs about maybe 68 inches underground, because, you know, that's, you're just looking for something going back 60, 70 years, not, you know, thousands. So we found a little piece of metal, and I had it analyzed here in Colorado, had electron scanning microscope analysis done on it, and it was aluminum silicon alloy. And I had done analysis twice to make sure that was the case, because we had some new software come in for the machine we were using, and I ran it again. Well, then after that, I did a press release at Roswell asking for help to figure out what this artifact really is. And lo and behold, Robert Bigelow pops up. And he says, I'll do it. And of course, at that time, we didn't know that he can. Of course, we didn't know at that time he was actually being funded by the Pentagon. We didn't know, you know, when, you know, he was being funded by the Pentagon around the STAR team time. So, you know, he did the analysis on it. And basically within the first week that, now I got, let me go back just a second. Okay, so you have this artifact that you found at the famous Roswell debris site, okay? Matter of fact, Roswell anniversary, 75 years this year. So it's gonna be a big to-do there at Roswell in July. So you find this artifact, and the one thing that investigators or experienced investigators know what not to do is, if you're gonna do an analysis on an artifact, you never give up the whole artifact. You cut a piece off the artifact and you send the piece to the lab, mm-hmm. because the artifact may just, you know, disappear. We know that. So, So, you know, the artifact, I don't have the artifact. The artifact is owned by the university, or by New Mexico, the state of New Mexico, and is archived. And the reason why is because it was a New Mexico funded archaeology dig. And so when we did an archaeology dig, it wasn't just a bunch of yahoos out there. We were working with archaeologists. So everything was done properly, like you're doing. We were doing, you know, a sanctioned archaeology dig. So I was able to get the, it was through the University of New Mexico, I was able to get a piece of it cut off. It took a couple of months to do this, and then had that piece sent to Bigelow. And once Bigelow got the piece, within 1 week, I got an email saying, well, this is interesting. It's an unknown polymer based on the known polymers that we have cataloged in our lab. I got an email on that. Now, it doesn't mean it's unknown to this planet. It just means it's not common. Mm-hmm. And that was a big yay, you know, for me, because that piece of aluminum alloy automatically eliminated aluminum foil. It eliminated any type of foil that may be on the cigarette, you know, packs back in, and, you know, back in the 40s or 50s, mm-hmm. and eliminated a lot of things that were, I mean, like Project Mogul, right? I mean, the whole premise behind Roswell was, you know, the Air Force came out and says, well, it's this high altitude balloon, experiment we were doing, or actually it was not really an experiment, but the pieces, they always stated that the parts of the balloon and the parts of the technology they were using in Project Mogul being a high altitude balloon chain, what it was doing, it was trying to detect any type of above ground atomic testing from our neighbors. Okay.
Russia.
So, right, right. And so, but they did come out and say the project was secret, but not the parts themselves. You could buy the parts at Radio Shack, you know, well, maybe not now because Radio Shack's gone, but you know, you could back then you could buy it from any place that sold, you know, electronic parts. So it was pretty cool that when we got the initial lab result back saying this is not a common aluminum silicon alloy, that we knew that, or I knew that it didn't come just from, it just didn't come from like a Radio Shack. It wasn't a common part. So I asked him, I said, so what's next? And the scientist I was working with Bass, said, we're going to do a analysis to see if it's from this planet. And I thought, okay, that's pretty cool. You know, they're gonna start looking at that of the event so quickly, right? Mm-hmm. So that was the last I heard of them.
That reminds me of, I don't know if this is the same case or not, but there was a case where they found metals, whether it was Roswell or wherever, alleged UFO crash site, and they analyzed the metal, and it was an alloy, and can't remember exactly which components it had, but there were two different components comprising this alloy. And the scientist said, the problem is these two components will not mix. Metallurgy knows that these two components will not mix to make an alloy. And yet here it is right in front of them. So they're not going to say that it's from outer space, another planet. Both of the components were earthly, okay? Except they will not mix to make an alloy. But once again, there it was right in front of them. Was that the case there?
Yeah, well, you know, there has been a couple of different cases out, you know, out of Roswell. You know, there we have two sites. We have the Roswell debris site, and then we have the Plains of St. Augustine. And Chuck Wade, he's basically been the lead investigator for the Plains of St. Augustine. Don Schmidt, Tom Carey were heading up the debris site near Corona. And that's how my sister Debbie and I first got involved. Mm-hmm. We were at Roswell, I don't know, 99, 2000 or whatever. And I had become friends with Glenn Dennis and Walter Hodd over the years, way before that. When I lived in California, I started off as, you know, investigating and researching Roswell. And I would go to Roswell, you know, a couple times a year via vacation or whatever. And it got to a point where Walter Hodd and Glenn Dennis knew me. Mm-hmm. And eventually Glenn Dennis gave me the GPS coordinates to the BLM marker that was nearby the debris site. That's how I had it. But supposedly, I mean, the story goes that there was two craft, and you know, during, you know, the July 4th timeframe, they were flying, you know, over Roswell Army Air Force Base and had probably headed towards White Sands. And one theory is if they kind of collided during a thunderstorm, one went down at the Plains of St. Augustine, New Mexico. The other one went down near Corona, New Mexico. That's kind of an interesting theory. I have my own, kind of have my own theory that's kind of like a general theory based on my own investigations of what actually happened. But so you have debris, you know, near Corona, then you have debris in the Plains of St. Augustine. And I know that Chuck Wade's debris had been analyzed a lot because he was able to pick up a lot of debris. As for the debris at Roswell, there has been some debris found there. Ours is the debris that I found was, you know, my opinion, pretty significant because it's, you know, it matches everything supposedly from what Marcel saw, right? which was pretty cool. Other debris, you know, not so much, or maybe, but you know, it's hard to say. And Jesse Marcel Jr., I knew very, very well. My sister and I actually took Jesse Marcel Jr. to the debris site. No other investigator ever offered to do that. Yeah. In all the years that he went to Roswell for the festival, that we offered, and finally the second or third time we offered to take him, he agreed.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a 2.5 hour drive up there, so it was pretty cool.
So I need to take a moment just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, your host, and we're speaking with the investigator and Mr. Chuck Zukowski. Chuck, tell us about, in your TV show, Alien Highway, you investigated a case of strange animal deaths near West Cliff, Colorado. Tell our listeners about that.
No, that was really cool. The West Cliff, Colorado case, it's still something going on there.
Mm-hmm.
I was dealing with one particular rancher, and he had lost a couple of animals. He had lost a horse, and then later he lost a cow, and then a pig instead, or something else. But we knew that we had some mutilation cases there. There was signs that there were mutilation cases in the past, and just like in Weston, Colorado, and Trinidad, Colorado, which I was doing a lot of investigations. But this particular case, something was going on there that was on top of, you know, the phenomenon of animal mutilation. There's an organization there was trying to hide something from going on. We found, I mean, there was cases where there was just multiple cows that were found dead. There was a case, you know, where elks were found dead, and some horses too.
What organization was this?
Well, I think what was happening was, in my opinion, I think there was an actual phenomenon of animal mutilation there on and off, but I think there was something biological going on there too that was being covered up. And some of the ranchers I talked to refused to talk to me. One in particular, you know, were pretty much threatened us to, you know, me and actually I was with a local news reporter and, you know, threatened to shoot us to, you know, get off his property because he had dead animals there. Another rancher actually blocked the road, you know, a little dirt road going to a house that we were going to interview the person there who had seen multiple animals. So there was a lot, there still is. There is something going on there. Something happened there where I think what might have happened is one of the local ranchers that brings in animals from out of state, you know, to breed, were infected with something and it had spread and it was killing other animals. So, I mean, it's really interesting because some of my investigations, UFO investigations, will slide into something else. And this was one of those cases where it slid into something that turned out to be more of a viral.
Okay, but that doesn't cancel out the fact that there were the mutilations, not mutilations, but what is the word I'm grasping for here? Not incisions, excise.
Well, that's what got us. Yeah, that's what got us there in the first place was, you know, the rancher's horse was pregnant. And then when the veterinarian basically did a necropsy on the horse, the fetus or was gone.
Right.
So that was it falls right into the paranormal part of animal mutilation. And then we found out about another animal mutilation that was nearby, and that's what got me there in the first place. Mm-hmm. And then so while investigating that, this other thing cropped up, fell flat in our faces about all these other animals that were dying due to a possible viral infection. Now, because of the viral thing, that pretty much stopped my animal mutilation investigation, because I couldn't go anywhere. Yeah. And people weren't talking to me. Okay. So that was kind of interesting. I still kind of watch it now to see, see if anything else is going on. And I've been there a couple of times since then on my own, just talking to the locals, seeing if anything else is going on over there. Unfortunately, the investor or the cattle rancher that I was investigating passed away last year. Mm-hmm. So it's unfortunate.
Skeptics have blamed satanic rituals and predators and even the military for these mutilations. How would you answer them?
Yeah, they don't know what they're talking about. That's just an excuse. In a UFO nutshell, because UFO Nuts is my website. Yeah, they don't know what they're talking about. They're just, these are the skeptics and debunkers, or what I like to call, couch investigators. Mm-hmm. They just read, they hear things, and they believe particular things, and then they're very, very opinionated on absolutely knowing nothing. They've never been on the field themselves and never seen the animals. Right. They never talked to the ranchers. Now, what's interesting about animal mutilation cases is, we had Snippy the horse. Actually, Snippy's name was Lady. The media got it wrong. But we're looking at, the late 60s, 67, when mm-hmm. the first mutilation in Colorado actually went public. And it was, the bones or the animal was found at the base of Blanca Peak near Alamosa. And matter of fact, Judy Meslin of a UFO watchtower nearby purchased the bones. And so she'll probably have the bones on display at the watchtower, if she doesn't already. So it's kind of interesting. It took a while to find them, but they kept them, because it was such a powerful press release, and it went all over the world. Well, since then, we've estimated, and actually George Knapp is the one that started researching and estimating, that we've had well over 10,000 cases of animal mutilations across the United States since 67. Now, out of all the animal mutilations that were investigated by law enforcement has never found the perpetrator. It was never, they found no evidence that it was a predator, and they found no evidence that it was a human. No human has ever been caught and convicted. Now, here in Colorado, if you're caught trying to kill an animal, on a ranch, the rancher can shoot you. He can do whatever he or she needs to do to protect their livestock. That's a livestock law here in Colorado.
It's their livelihood.
Exactly. And what's interesting about animal mutilations is all the ones that I've done, the ranchers have contacted me because now these are second and third generation ranchers. And because they don't understand how the animal died, they see animal deaths all the time due to, natural causes. But when they see an animal that's dead, that they have no idea how it died, that's what's scary. Mm-hmm. And there's been cases where it's physically infected the ranchers and physically infected the animals that mm-hmm. touched the carcass.
Yeah.
And so for those particular cases that fall into the paranormal, and I have to say this to all your listeners out there. First off, all these TV shows of ghost investigators and we're paranormal investigators. The word paranormal means anything basically out of the normal. And that covers everything from Mothman to Bigfoot to animal mutilations, UFOs, for whatever reason, ghost investigators seem to think that paranormal just means ghosts. That's not the case.
No.
That's why I'm known as a UFO paranormal. I have to throw the paranormal in there for those people who don't understand. But, right. You know, that it's that UFO is a paranormal. So for a paranormal event to happen to this or to these animals, first the animal is completely voided of blood, and then the cuts are made. And then organs are removed from, you know, or taken from the animal too. And there's never any evidence of blood around the animal. And there's, oh, it's so cool. There's never evidence that the animal actually struggled. So you walk up to one of these, and this is the part that just blows away the skeptics and the debunkers. They have, I mean, they have really no way of debating this. Okay. Yeah. They can say whatever they want, but you know, if you try to kill an animal or you shoot an animal, it's going to fall over. It's going to struggle, and it'll kick around and stuff. Every one of these cases, the animal is laying completely, or the carcass is completely still in the ground. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely no signs that head moved, no signs that leg moved. It's almost as if it was a fiberglass cow that's just laying there. And sometimes,
or did not die in that at that place.
Yeah, you know what? I got to tell you, seems like every animal mutilation case I do, I learn more. You know, I always learn new things, and I've learned over the time that I've done so many of these that we've always known that the animals, you know, they're taken from location A to location B. They're drained of blood. Now, this is based on my own investigations. They're drained of blood and then they're cut. And I'll tell you why in a minute. And then they're taken to location C, which is in the general area of location A where they first came from. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I know they're being drained of blood before they're cut is because I've taken so many samples to the Colorado State University Veterinary Lab that it shows no hemorrhaging. So the animal was not alive when it was cut, or else there'd be hemorrhaging on the cut marks. Right. There'd be some signs of, so that's kind of nice to know that the animal was bled out and dead first and then cut up, mm-hmm. that there was no struggle. The animal didn't go through, you know, the pain of being cut up while it was alive.
When We Are Not Alone was a local TV show, I had a skeptic on the show who said that he had discussed mutilations with a vet. Now, he never investigated, but he discussed this with a vet who claimed that the blood settles to the bottom of the animal, and that's why UFO investigators never find any blood. Well, what do you say to that?
Well, we've opened up the cows.
Yeah.
And I physically took an animal to the Colorado State Veterinary Lab, and it was void of blood. The carcass was there. Yeah. The whole animal. I took the whole animal.
Well, I said to this guy, what do you think these vets who investigate this, the UFO investigators, don't turn the cow over, don't investigate, they just look at the top of the animal and go on about their business? Oh, it's drained to the bottom. He didn't have an answer for that. It's just,
well, we've actually look. I mean, within 24 hours, you know, you look for blood pooling. That's the first thing you look for.
Right.
And you look for it because you want to determine, first off, whether or not it's considered the paranormal part. It is actual animal mutilation, or the animal just didn't die. And so we've, you know, there was never any, you know, I mean, these are gallons of blood, you know, not looking at pints. You're looking at gallons of blood in an animal that's 1,100 pounds, right? Mm. But out of those cases that we were able to look inside the carcass or cut it open, you've never seen any, you'd be able to see gallons of blood in there. And over a period of time, if it was inside, it would eventually saturate the hide and saturate that part of the soil. And I mean, this is just the physics part of it. Mm-hmm. And that's never been the case. But the interesting thing about these cases is, you know, when you talk to, you know, like the Linda Moulton Howes and Chris O'Brien's, which they're not really field investigators. One's a journalist investigator. that she really doesn't know that much about field investigation. And Chris is more, I don't know what happened to Chris O'Brien, but it almost seems like he's working for somebody else because, you know, the way he's been lecturing recently, he's saying it's all been involved with someone within a government that's doing it, which I don't understand that. But the thing is when you really look at the science of this and as a, let's say a detective, okay, and I was with law enforcement for 8 years, you look at it from like a animal mutilation detective. So you're looking at this animal here, it hasn't moved at all, just laying there, no scuff marks on the ground from any part of its limbs that are moving, but the animal appears to have been dropped. And you'll hear other investigators talk about it, but they don't really understand. Oh yeah, they were dropped from a helicopter, or they were dropped from here, or blah, 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 blah. You know, you always hear that until you actually have done enough of these and you can become experienced with this, that you realize they're not dropped, they're placed. And you go, what? They're placed. And I've had so many cases where the animal, you'll see it sitting on the ground and there'll be like an impact from a meteorite, you know, where the dirt's pushed up that right. Hit the ground hard. That's what you're thinking, oh, it was dropped. And then some of the bones inside are broken or crushed once you get into the animal and you look at that. Now, if a cow falls over, and here's another thing about skeptics, okay? They really need to, most of these skeptics are from the city. They've never talked to a rancher or been a rancher in their life, except maybe a petting zoo, right? You know, well, the animal fell over or broke its bones. Really? Really? How about cow tipping, which used to be the craze back in the day?
Right.
You know, cows sleep standing up and the kids used to walk up and push the cow over. They didn't kill it. It didn't fall over and crush all its bones and die. So, you know, the ranchers actually laugh at that. They laugh at the people that say that. They go, these guys are morons. They don't know what the hell they're talking about.
So what makes you think that it wasn't dropped from a height?
And it's really interesting. Now, it's real simple. So for your listeners, take a pen, all right, and about even 2-3 inches off the table and just drop the pen. Does it land and not move at all? Or is there a little bit of movement in the pen?
Okay.
When you drop it, drop a paper clip. You pick it, you know, drop something at different heights. And and my aha moment was when I was with the law enforcement. You know, we were trained in a lot of different things, especially as suicides, and we've had to watch a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of videos of people who had committed suicide. And the videos are picked up from security cameras, and every one of the jumpers that died by jumping, the body bounces.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, even if you fall off your first story house, you just don't go kaplot, you know, you'll bounce. So you'll move a little bit at least. And that's the case with a 12 or 1100 pound animal. It's going to move a little bit. So the animal is physically placed, and depending on how it was placed, maybe by different, okay, depending on how it was placed or the amount of force it was placed will depend on how it'll impact the ground or it will break the bones. I mean, I've seen rib cages dislocated from the backbone. I've seen legs that were broken just from the amount of power of them being placed on the ground. Now people are going, well, how do you know? I mean, what other evidence do you have that you're able to say it was placed? And I go, aha. So I'm one of the first investigators that noticed that some of the mutilations the animals are lying in what appears to be a crop circle. It's not as visual as a crop circle, but you can clearly see if you look, and sometimes I'll pick it up using a full spectrum camera that I shoot during the daytime, where I can see things, you know, in infrared and IR during the daytimes that you can't see with your eyes. And I can see that the ground has been altered anywhere from 16 to 22 feet in diameter, like a circle. So when I see that, I'll take soil samples from inside a circle and I'll take soil samples a good 20 feet away from the outside of the circle. And I'll have analysis done on sample A and sample B. Now, for the listeners out there going, well, what do you know about taking soil samples? And I go, well, I contacted a company that takes soil samples, or the BLM for, you know, Four Corners here, you know, Colorado, New Mexico, and whatever, you know, that they take their soil to. And I talked to them about this originally when I started to take soil samples, and they instructed me on how to properly take soil samples to get the best lab analysis. You just can't just take soil samples. There's a kind of a different way you got to do it, right, to make sure you get the best lab analysis. Then you send them in lab A, or soil sample A and soil sample B. You don't want to give them any information. And all you say is compare the two.
Yeah.
And you do a full nutrient soil analysis on it. And guess what? Every single time I've sent soil samples in, the soil in the circle near the cow, the stications or the water solubility of the soil is less, meaning that the soil itself has been impacted with something that makes it less soluble to water. So the nutrients have physically changed near the animal. Okay. Now, we've done this in Colorado, and I've done it Missouri and also in Georgia. Even though we have three different states with three different types of soil sample or soils, Missouri is very good with clay, analysis are the same. So now you're going, well, how can that be? Well, I was one of the first investigators. Did you need to take a break or something?
Yeah, I needed to take a break to let our listeners know one more time that they're listening to WHFR.FM, Station Making Waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with UFO investigator, Mr. Chuck Sikowski. And so yeah, we were talking about these soil samples and cattle mutilations, but there's also you and the Alien Highway team examined a mysterious ring formation found in the grass of a resident's property in Salem, Missouri. When mapping the area, both cameras malfunctioned and a strange white van arrived on the scene. What significance do you feel there is in that?
Well, that's what's the interesting thing that I was kind of talking about before you hit the break was, I was one of the first investigators to use an electromagnetic field or an EMF meter on animal mutilations. And so I was able to pick up high levels of electromagnetic field on some of the cows and then some of the circles itself, if you get there fast enough before it dissipates. So it was a high EM field or an energy source that altered the nutrients in the ground. And I believe that's why, you know, the soil samples picked that up. Mm-hmm. Now, this is something that we've been doing as UFO investigators, like you mentioned with Alien Highway. Anytime I see any signs of a possible something touching down or something touching, you know, vegetation, the first thing I'll do is I'll hit it with an EMF, you know, meter, and looking for any signs of higher electromagnetic fields. And we've been doing that for years and years as a UFO investigator. I think J. Allen Hynek started using it way back then. You even used to use compasses back in the day. So with the Alien Highway thing, while we were filming that particular circle, which is very reminiscent of the circle that cows are found in sometimes, you know, so there's a correlation there, right, you know, same people. As I was going to take
people
samples.
People, and you use that term loosely.
Yes. and what was really interesting about this is, you know, it had been a couple of months. You know, you have to understand too, for your listeners, that my daytime job, I'm a microchip designer. I'm in the microchip design field, and I've been doing that 30 years. So I totally understand you know, the concepts of electronics and EMF and ESD and all EMP, everything. I've done investigations. I mean, I've done projects in microchip design for space, you know, for deep space satellites and for military stuff. So you have to be aware of rad hard or radioactive and design a microchip to be able to, you know, to, you know, keep that from actually affecting the chip itself. So you have to filter all that out. But basically, so I'm aware of electromagnetic fields because I deal with them in my in designs. Mm. So when you see that on the ground, you know, and I know as an engineer that that the energy is only going to be there for a certain period of time unless there's something in the ground that's retaining that energy, because it'll eventually it'll dissipate. Mm. But it was such a significant site, and it was only been a few months old, that there was enough electromagnetic field left embedded in the soil that it hadn't dissipated enough yet. Now, that's why I was going to take soil samples to see, you know, what was in the soil above the top soil or where the grass was, to see if I could pick up anything there. And then so while I was in there and the cameraman's following me in there, his camera, and they use these $70,000 red cameras. That's the manufacturer red, same type of cameras they use to shoot the Marvel movies with. So it's not a cheap camera. His camera just reset. And then a second camera started flickering. And it was really interesting is when that happened, he stopped and I went, well, what's going on? He says, well, my camera's just started. I said, hang on a second. And I ran back to my kit. I got my EMF meter. And I just assumed it's been a few months that I wouldn't pick up an EM field, but there was still an EM field there. I talked to the directors of the show. And I said, listen, guys, I know this is your show. I know I'm not a director or producer, but I said, you got to keep that in. You have to show in the TV show that camera going out, because there's multiple things going on here. Not only, you know, am I getting a high EM field, you know, with my meter, but it's so high that it knocked out this $80,000 camera. You've got to show that. Now, what they didn't, I wish they would have, we had a drone that was flying overhead showing, you know, that was going to show me taking soil samples, and it was fine. But when the drone operator brought the drone down to land it, it refused to land. Now, I have a drone sitting right behind me. I have a DJI Phantom 4, and it's kind of outdated, but even for that technology, it'll land itself. And it has a sonar, and it has a camera, and it knows where the ground is, and you go land, and it'll slowly land. His drone refused to land. His drone was more advanced than mine. It couldn't find the ground. Wow. Even though it was 4 feet off the ground, and he was trying to land it near the circle, and it refused to land. It said error on his mind. It wouldn't land. It says, you know, and the technology. So it picked up some type of anomaly that its sensors couldn't see the ground, even though the camera could, but the sensor said, something's going on. The ground's not there. I can't land it there. And so he had to move it away to be able to land it. But as he was moving, he just walked over and grabbed it with his hand anyway, which most of them do. But I wanted to show that also in the show, because that also shows another, you know, highly advanced. That's the same issue. Now this is, you go back to the cattle mutilations, that's what's happening there. So I believe that there was a high energy source that's lifting and taking the animals, and then the high energy source that's putting them back down. Now, depending on the intensity of the source, how powerful it is, it could cause the animal to come down hard and hit, and be placed on the ground hard, or not so hard, depending. And maybe the intensity of the source may be due to the elevation of the object that is in control of the source, maybe closer to the ground. You know, if the animal comes down harder and bones are broken inside and you get that cavity, you know, that ground cavity. That's my opinion.
Well, there's also been a case, at least one case, where they found a cow in the tree, up in the tree.
That is, well, and that just kind of proves the whole cow jumping over the moon scenario. I've investigated two cases, or actually I tried to investigate two cases where we had that. We had one that was a pig that was in the power lines.
Wow.
Yeah. And then we had another one where it was a cow that came down on top of some boulders and some rocks. And there was no way the cow could have climbed up there because it was even hard for a human to climb up a cow's, you know, unless this particular cow was part goat. But both cases, I was able to interview the people who actually saw it, but we had, it'd been a while, we didn't, you know, they didn't have proof of it. This was pre-cell phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's kind of, but it was in the same area, Weston, Colorado, where there's been multiple mutilations. And of course, excuse me, we have another one, another place that Walsenburg, Colorado, where I investigated 8 mutilations at one time within about a, they all occurred within about a week or so. And that one was a really, really good investigation because not only were there so many animals involved within a week, week and a half of being mutilated with exactly the same cuts, all of them, that there was also UFOs that were seen after, and then black helicopters or unmarked helicopters that were seen after running their own investigations, 1:30 or so in the morning out there. I interviewed the rancher who saw it. And then also a couple months prior to the mutilations, there was a couple of, and I talked to air traffic control here and out of Denver, that there were a couple of commercial airlines that they said that it looked as if that they were being hit, or they could say see a high intense laser, but it wasn't like a laser that was hitting them in the eyes. They could just see flashes of, like, it looked like a laser light, and they diverted around that area. That happened a couple months before. They didn't say it was a laser, but they just, the pilots just assumed it was because the flashes of light were so bright that they assumed it could have been a laser. They contacted air traffic control, and air traffic control actually diverted. I talked to the sheriff's deputy in that area who investigated, you know, the laser, the areas where the pilots, you know, reported the laser. All that happened in the exact same area where we lost 8 animals due to mutilations. Laser, flashes of light, UFOs, black helicopters, unmarked helicopters running. Now, the helicopters on any type of investigation, if it be UFO or animal mutilations, if they're seen afterwards, no, they are not responsible for what happened. They're running their own investigation. We talked about this earlier. The Pentagon, it still does, right? Especially from June 25th of last year, where they came out and released, you know, the whole information, like, okay, yeah, we understand there's stuff flying over. We need to investigate it. We need to create new technology to be able to understand what's flying over, because our fighter jets technology cannot identify what they're tracking. So now we have to create new technology to try to identify what our fire pilots are saying. That's if you don't believe me, just read the report from June 25th last year from the Pentagon. That's what it says. I'm not making this up.
We only have about 5 minutes left, I'm afraid, but I did want to ask you about your team with the highway, alien highway, also used binary light signaling to communicate with a possible UFO near Utah's Skinwalker Ranch. And tell us briefly about that. And do you feel that you have data to contribute to the team that's presently investigating the ranch?
That's just the TV. That team investigates, it's just TV. Okay, I'm sorry. It's just TV. I've been investigating.
You know, with all due respect, Chuck, your Alien Highway is just for TV.
No, right? I'm talking about the ranch itself.
Oh, okay.
The ranch itself. Okay, for anybody that's listening to this, look, I've been investigating the Skinwalker Ranch with actually going onto the ranch for years. I've been out in Utah a few times. You don't have to be actually on the ranch. You can be within a 5-mile radius of that ranch and you get some really, really awesome stuff. You talk to the locals there, you interview the local Native Americans, they'll tell you it's been going on for a long time. The Skinwalker Ranch is nothing more like the Bradshaw Ranch. As a matter of fact, I know two other places that are more active than the Skinwalker Ranch. Mm-hmm. And I'm not knocking the Skinwalker Ranch. The Skinwalker Ranch just happened to be a ranch that was a place that you could purchase that, you know, that was in an area that was already hot, that has been hot for centuries.
Do you think it's a vortex, a wormhole?
There's some, yeah. And if people go on my website, you know, one of my blogs is about hydrogen. And I think hydrogen is an element that is being used by our visitors. And it turns out that you could pull hydrogen pretty easy from our natural resources, meaning oil. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Skinwalker Ranch is sitting on a very lucrative oil reserve. And so you can pull hydrogen from oil, you can pull hydrogen from aquifers. And so there's other places that I've been looking at in the U.S. that have high UFO activity, that there's a lot of water. As a matter of fact, most of my investigations and animal mutilations are near water sources. So that's really interesting too. No, I'm nothing disrespectful about, you know, I don't want to say anything disrespectful about the Skinwalker Ranch, but for all your listeners out there, all you got to do, if you're interested in anything like that, you don't have to worry about going to the Skinwalker Ranch. Just go anywhere within, like I said, 4 or 5 miles of that area, and I guarantee you will have some type of experience. Same thing with the Bradshaw Ranch. You can't get into the Bradshaw Ranch in Sedona, right? But anywhere around Sedona, if you want to just hang out there at night and star watch, you're bound to see something, you know. But make sure you're properly equipped, you know, with night vision,
right,
equipment and stuff, right, or EMF or something. But
It seems like water and also nuclear energy, be it just the energy itself or wherever there's nuclear power, seems to attract these visitors.
Absolutely. They're into technology. They want to see what we're into. And that's been going on. I mean, you've heard of stories in the past that, you know, some of our bases, you know, the nuclear bases, that the missiles were shut down. They have the technology, it's advanced technology. I mean, that's why they're able to, you know, outfly our pilots.
Right. Where can our listeners go to find out more about your work, about that book, 37 Parallel?
Just go to ufonut.com. That's my website. You can check out Alien Highway. It's out there, you know, being seen in different venues. I know Amazon Prime and Comcast and stuff. And then Unexplained Files, you know, Paranormal Highway. That was just on not too long ago.
You go to YouTube?
Yeah, go to YouTube and you can see the videos on YouTube also. If you have any questions, just email me. Just go to my website, ufonut.com. It's called UFO Nut because when I started doing this 35 years ago, people were calling me crazy, calling me nuts. So I decided to roll with it.
You might as well. Chuck, it's been great having you on. And I know you've got a lot of information. Maybe we can do this again, okay?
Oh, absolutely. We just touched the tip of the iceberg.
Very good. I'll get back with you then, Chuck.
Okay, thank you very much. And thank you very much for having me on your show. I appreciate that.
Thank you for coming on.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you'll find my website with all the archive shows. Please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you, to keep an eye on the sky.